Good evening. My name is John Ohmschneider. I'm the University Librarian here at Virginia Commonwealth University. And on behalf of the faculty, students, and staff of Virginia Commonwealth University, I extend to all of you a warmest welcome to our 14th celebration of the Cabell First Novelist Award. The VCU Libraries is a proud sponsor with the Cabell Associates and others to provide some of the financial and logistic support for the Cabell First Novelist Program each year. This is the eighth year of co-sponsorship between the College of the Humanities and Sciences, the Cabell Associates, and the VCU Libraries to support the Cabell First Novelist Program. And I have to say, very few partnerships have enjoyed the kind of amazing success that we've had in this collaboration. Since 2008, the VCU Cabell First Novelist Award has grown enormously in stature and in recognition, and is now a keystone award, I'm glad to say, for writers who publish their first novel, and also a keystone literary event for the Virginia literary arts community. Many thanks especially go first and foremost to the Cabell Associates for their support of the VCU Cabell First Novelist. Founded way back in 1981 by Margaret Cabell, the wife of Richmond novelist James Branch Cabell, after whom the library is named, the Cabell Associates continue today to encourage scholarly work about James Branch Cabell, to foster his legacy, to elevate his profile as one of America's most distinguished literary artists, and to help us all understand that he was a writer who helped define the role and the art of fantasy writing for the likes of Neil Gaiman and others, and who remains today one of the country's most distinctive historical voices of political satire. The VCU Cabell First Novelist Award annually honors an outstanding debut novel published during the preceding calendar year. Every year, the English department receives well over 100 submissions and recruits a small army of students, faculty, staff, and others from around the university to screen books and to let us know their favorites. We have many members of our broader community who, as you can imagine, are a well-educated lot indeed when it comes to literary fiction, and we're delighted that they also participate in this review. In fact, community members, those of you who are here, including VCU Friends of the Library, you can already check out books and read for novels for this year's award. You can find them on the first floor of James Branch Cabell Library, just ask at the desk. Guided by the screener reviews, the English department chooses three finalists for the Cabell First Novelist. These books are then sent to a panel of judges, which includes the previous year's winner, other authors, and local readers who choose the final winner. The diverse group of past Cabell First Novelist winners includes many novelists who have gone on to become major voices in their field. Recent winners include Helen Wecker for her celebrated fantasy-tinged The Gollum and the Jinni, which has just been auctioned for a TV series, I understand. So that'll be pretty interesting. And Ramona Asubel for No One Is Here Except All of Us, a magical tale that grapples with history and the horrors of war and has been optioned for a movie. So these are folks who are very successful, and you can see that selecting the first Cabell First Novelist is a rigorous process that leads to winners who go on to do just wonderful things. That's why we're so proud to have this year's winner, Boris Fishman, with us tonight. I know we all look forward to hearing him read and to learning more about his work. Now, by tradition, the previous year's VCU Cabell First Novelist Coordinator, who actually organized and did all the process to select this year's winner, gets to present the author each year. And so introducing the winner tonight is Kate Zipse, a third-year student in the MFA in Creative Writing program who is specializing in fiction writing. So Kate, come on up. Thank you.
Good evening, everyone, and thank you so much for coming out tonight. As he said, my name is Kate Zipse, and I'm a third-year MFA student and co-coordinator of this year's Cabell First Novelist Award. For you first-timers here tonight, this means I got to read through and Fall in Love and then Eliminate the stacks and stacks of first-time novels that were sent in contending to survive. But, as we all know, only one novel made it out alive, which is why we're here tonight to mourn the death of those other novels. No, just kidding. No, we're here to celebrate the winner, of course, Boris Fishman and A Replacement Life. One cool thing about the First Novelist Award is that it began as an offshoot of the MFA's novel workshop with the idea that as us students are writing our novel, we also get to study and ask questions to this really good or best published first-time novelist. So last year, I got to take the novel workshop. And in it, I began to write this sort of coming-of-age story about a high school girl who struggles to understand herself and make decisions amidst a tangled and often oppositional web of identities and relationships. She feels like she has to choose between these separate and seemingly absolute parts of her. She, like many people, is figuring out how to navigate and constantly re-navigate the gray zones of herself. So, how does this relate? After reading A Replacement Life, Boris and his characters taught me and my character something important about this journey, about entering and exploring and wrestling and befriending the gray zones of a self. In the back of his book, you'll see, if you buy it, which you should, there's some commentary from Boris, and in one of the passages he says, Ariana introduces Slava to the idea that you don't have to be one thing or the other, that you can be as much or as little of both as you like, and that no one other than yourself should tell you how much and from where. You can care both about high heels and poetry, you can be a little false and a little true, a little fraudulent and a little honest, a little Jewish and a little not, a little Russian and a little American. Slava is a fundamentalist when he begins, out of a discomfort with gray zones. But so often, that's where the truth is, in the gray zone. It is the truth of which I believe writers must remind their audiences. So there's this other level to the gray zone I wanted to touch on, and it's how this book plays with heavy and light. I can't tell you how many times over the last 3 years I've sat down and I thought, I want to write this part of me, but it's so heavy. And I'm faced with this question, okay, how can I bring this other side of me into that darkness? The levity, resilience, connectivity, humor, into these complex and difficult narratives and questions. How do they make sense together, and how do they tell a story? One that's happy and sad, funny and serious, and all at once. To answer that question, of course, I have to draw my own map, but I'm grateful I have books like Boris's to draw and gain inspiration from. Darren Strauss says, "A Replacement Life is a hell of a book, told with amazing virtuosity, fun and serious, funny and sad, profound and eminently readable. It will make you happy until it's over, and then it will make you sad." San Francisco Chronicle says, "Fishman, like his protagonist, is a born storyteller with a tremendous gift for language on all brow levels, making for a captivating and rare first novel that is tender, learned, funny, and deeply soulful, frequently all at the same time." So I have to out Boris and tell you guys that he requested to please skip this sleep-inducing list of residencies, press, publications, and awards. So I thought, geez, did he like pull a Slava and make up a fraudulent bio or something? So I crept onto his website and printed out what I found. And I think really what he meant is that I just do not have time to read these accomplishments. So yeah, I'm gonna have to steal some of these myself for my own semi-fictional bio and learn from very clever Slava. Please join me in welcoming the winner of VCU Cabell First Novelist Award, Mr. Boris Fishman.
What an amazing intro. Thank you, Kate. I'm usually being introduced by people who haven't read the novel. It's a very different experience when this level of attention has been given to it, but that's the level of attention I've gotten from. This has been so well organized, which is also not something I can say for most of the events that I do. I don't know if these names will mean anything to you, but I do want to single out Kate Zipsy and Gregory Kimbrell and Cade Varnado. They all have very complicated names to pronounce. In fact, I still don't know if Gregory's name. Is Gregory here? Is it Gregory Kimbrell?
Yes.
All right. When you're doing something like this and you're traveling away from home, it's so wonderful to be in the hands of people who know what they're doing and are not only super competent, but very warm and welcoming. And so I'm really grateful, to say nothing of the award, for how smooth the ride has been up to here. And thank you again for that introduction. So I don't think I have to tell you what it means to get an award like this, first novel or 10th. It's been mostly uphill on the way here, and it hardly stops being that way. even after an award such as this one. So it's incredibly gratifying, and I'm humbled and grateful. And when I learned that this award is unusual in that in its early stages, the community contributes to the decision-making process. The semifinalists and the finalists are picked in part by the members of the Richmond community. That was really gratifying to hear as well. It's not something I come across often, and it's so refreshing and cool. We've had a bang-up time down here. It's really nice where you live for all kinds of reasons. So I'm happy to be here. It's too bad there's no Cabell Second Novelist Award. I've got another one coming out in March. So I was only mainly supposed to read, and we were going to talk later on, and we are going to talk later on. But I just wanted to say a couple things quickly, because I've got this chance, and I see a lot of young people in the room, students. Just out of curiosity, how many of you are here because you're getting credit? I'm going to try to make it worth your while. Going to dispense some wisdom from the stage. Get those notebooks out. Very quickly, because I can go on. I tried to write the smartest possible book for the broadest possible audience. There's some kind of weird stigma attached to stories, to books that move quickly, to books where you want to turn the page, to books where you are dying to find out what happens next. I'm not making that claim for this novel necessarily, but it was so important for me to write a book that you wanted to race through. There's a lot of fretting around nowadays about books and the future of books and the future of fiction. Is the novel dead? It isn't dead at all if you give people a reason to turn the page. And unfortunately, I encounter too many books where the author has forgotten his or her responsibility to do that. And so those of you who are working on books of your own, I beg you to remember Dostoevsky wrote smart page turners. Elmore Leonard wrote smart page turners. Graham Greene, William Styron, all these people wrote beautiful, complicated books that you couldn't wait to finish. These two things, a page turner and a novel of ideas, are not irreconcilable. You might have to work a little bit harder, but you can do it. And it's what I was aspiring to do with this novel. The other thing that I wanted to say is I wanted, in addition to waving the flag high for stories, I wanted to do that as well for fiction with a serious moral message. I was talking about this earlier in a roundtable discussion that I had at the library. I feel like we live in a time when authors have abdicated their responsibility to tell people how to live. We live in a world of relative truths. You've got your own and I've got mine. And a lot of creative people that I encounter don't feel authorized to put that kind of instruction in their work. Well, I'm Russian born, and my undergraduate degree is in Russian literature. So maybe you'll understand why I'm up here telling you that I believe that books ought to show people a way forward. You don't have to agree with the conclusions that I come to in this novel. I don't even come to any conclusions. But the questions that I tried to discuss in it, I spent 4 years working over in my mind. And I guess what I'm saying with the novel is that these things are worth thinking about. And it is so, so inspiring to me to come across books that take this incredible opportunity. If I'm going to ask you to sit down for 320 pages, I better have something worthwhile to say. And I better prompt you and prod you and challenge you on all sorts of things, including how you're living your life. And that was one of my missions with this book. And again, to the extent that I have any authority with you as you're working on yours, I wanted to encourage you to do the same. Be serious and go big. There is no shame and there's only honor in doing that. It is the noblest thing that I believe an author can do. The last two things I wanted to say before I read to you is for those of you who are working on books of your own, who here is working on something, anything, formal, informal, more than those who are getting credit for being here. Two things. Number one, be kind to yourself. That may sound really woo-woo, but what I mean by that is part of the reason that it took so long is because I spent so much time beating myself up about not having the chops to do this. Certainly the world was giving me a lot of signals that I didn't have the chops to do this, and it's not easy to persevere. But precisely because the world just loves to say no, leave that incredible opportunity to the world. And don't waste time on it yourself. On the other hand, work like hell. Be animals about it. Treat it like a job and do it every single day, except the weekend. If you sit down and write, I understand that people have jobs. Sometimes you're tired when you get at home. Sometimes you can only get 3 hours on the weekend. I understand I'm getting into nuts and bolts here, but this is actually what matters. Whatever your time allotment is, make it religious. and do that, and do it over and over at the same time, over and over and over, week in and week out. And if you do that, I guarantee you that after a year or 2 years, you will have a manuscript on your hands. And so I think there's a lot of mystery and romance that gets attached to the process, and a lot of it is just time at the keyboard. And so at the same time, be kind to yourselves, but also be merciless. That's the message that I wanted to give you. I will leave the rest of it to our panel discussion. I'm just going to read to you briefly from the book. It is called A Replacement Life. In a sentence, it's about a young man, a failed writer, who starts forging Holocaust restitution claims for old Russian Jews in Brooklyn. These are the payouts the German government gives to survivors of the Holocaust. And Slava Gelman is indeed his name, and he ends up doing it quite reluctantly on behalf of people who have suffered during the war, but not in the exact way that they need to have suffered in order to qualify legally for restitution. And so one of the questions that the novel tries to raise is there ever such a thing as a just fraud? Who gets to decide what suffering is? And so on in that vein. And the other question that it tries to bring up is, how do we honor elders whose definition of honor is different? And the reason it talks about that is because Slava, who begins his life as an immigrant in America, much as I did, in a mainly Russian-speaking community in South Brooklyn, and he is just so profoundly embarrassed at having to live among these people. Because what Slava wants, above all, is to become a proper American. And so he says goodbye to all that and runs off to Manhattan, which, despite being quite close to Brooklyn, is an entirely different universe, and kind of sits there and waits for the Americanness to show up. And as we all know, that's not how identity works, but Slava doesn't know that, and this novel is his painful discovery of just why. And then, about a year after he's fled, refusing to call, refusing to visit, a phone call comes, and he finds out that his beloved grandmother, a Holocaust survivor, has passed away. And the letter inviting her to apply for this restitution that I'm talking about has shown up in the mail just a week after she's gone. And so Slava's grandfather says to him, "Why don't you write it anyway?" And Slava says, "But how can I? She's gone." And Slava's grandfather says, "Well, don't write it about her." And Slava says, "About whom then?" And grandfather says, "Write it about me." And Slava says, "But you were evacuated to safety in Uzbekistan." And grandfather says, "You're a writer, aren't you?" And so that's the premise and how it starts. Of course, Slava takes great pleasure in saying absolutely not until he has yet another failure at the magazine where he works and aspires to succeed. And tail between his legs comes crawling back to his grandfather, takes on the assignment, and of course the experience ends up transforming his life and complicating his sense of justice and family and honor and all of that. So that's basically the context for the story. The section I'm going to read to you, it's great when you plan to read one section but end up reading another. I'm going to read something else. This is the debate that Slava and grandfather have about the thing that grandfather wants Slava to do. And in the name of economy, I've crossed out a lot of things, so forgive me if I stumble a bit. So this is at the funeral dinner. People are in the living room toasting to grandmother's health. And grandfather has asked Slava to come into the bedroom to look at this letter that's come. In the hallway, Slava found grandfather looking lost. "Slavchik," grandfather said drowsily. His hands hung at his sides like a soldier's, only that his shoulders sagged. "People are leaving," Slava said. "No, no," grandfather said. "Something I need you to look at," he added, pointing to the bedroom. "We're both tired. Let's do it another day," Slava said. "Another day with you?" grandfather said. "Another day with you is a year from now. The deadline is soon. It'll take only a moment." Grandfather strode toward the bedroom, but stopped at the threshold. "Her slippers are right there, but she's not," he said. "What sense does that make?" Slava said nothing. He rubbed his nose in grandfather's hair, soft and straight as goose down, the hair of someone a third of his age. The old man nodded helplessly, a fat, lazy tear at his eye. Finally, he stepped into the bedroom and hooked a papery finger into the handle of a bureau, removing a straw pouch where he stuffed mail until Slava's mother came to translate. Unlike Slava, she came all the time. The item he wanted was out front, backed by circulars and forms. He sat down in the chair next to the bed, eyeing its satin slipcover like an untouchable object. "Look, please," he said, extending the envelope. Slava pulled out the roughly folded papers and inspected the lettering. He snagged on the Hebrew, blocky but graceful. Then he saw the English and whistled slightly. He had heard people in the office talking about it. "Dear you," he translated, "the conference on material claims against Germany..." "I know what it says," grandfather said. Mama translated, "If you were a Holocaust victim, tell the story and you get funds. They're saying, depending on what you went through, a bigger piece once or a smaller piece every month for the rest of your life. I did it on the calculator. If you survive for 10 months, you come out ahead." "Who's saying?" Slava said. "People at the Jewish Center on King's Highway." "Why do you listen to them?" Slava said. "It's a gossip mill." "Who else for me to listen to?" grandfather said. The last page in the packet was blank except for a heading. "Narrative. Please describe, in as much detail as you can, where the subject was during the years 1939 to 1945. 60 years they had," Slava said, "and they do it the moment she dies." "Well," grandfather hung his head. They investigated the window, South Brooklyn steaming in the dense July night. A clothesline strung with large underthings wavered in the breeze. "So," grandfather said, turning to face Slava, "can you write something?" Slava nearly laughed. This was grandfather. The rules were right there, but he was going to ask anyway. Slava searched for the word. Gone? Wasn't? They hadn't come to an acceptable word yet. "Not about grandmother," grandfather said. "About whom, then?" "About me." Now Slava laughed. "I don't think they're giving out restitution for evacuations to Uzbekistan." Grandfather poked the paper with a square nail. "They are, but it's dicey. Some yes, some no. Either way, it's less money. But ghettos and concentration camps? It's a green path all the way. So give me one of those. You're a writer, aren't you?" Slava opened his hands. "Now I'm a writer." "You write for the newspaper where you work," grandfather said. "That's what you said." "It's a magazine," Slava said. "So this is like an article for your newspaper." "Articles for my newspaper are not invented." "This country does not invent things," grandfather said, his eyes flashing. "Bush did not invent a reason to cut off Saddam's balls. When the stocks fall down, it's not because someone invented the numbers." "This country has nothing to do with it," Slava said. "You don't know how to do it," grandfather said. "Is that it?" "I do know how to do it," Slava said through his teeth. "Then do it," grandfather said. "For your grandmother, do it. I need to remind you that your great uncle Aaron, my brother, is in a mass grave in Latvia. Unkissed, he died. I wish you could read his letters, they weren't in Yiddish. I went after him with a butcher knife when they called him up. A pinky would have been enough to disqualify him, in 41 at least. My year, every boy conscripted in 43. He sliced his palm through the air, cut down like grass. He leaned in and whispered, "I wasn't going to volunteer to be cannon fodder. You wouldn't be here. I stayed alive." "What does Aaron have to do with it?" Slava said. "Look, it says ghettos, forced labor, concentration camps. What did the subject suffer between 1935 to 1945? The subject, not you. You didn't suffer." "I didn't suffer?" Grandfather's eyes sparkled. "I've got a grave already. I didn't suffer." I didn't mention that to you, but earlier when buying grandmother's burial plot, grandfather bought two in one go because there was a discount then. "God bless you, you know that?" "God bless you" is what a Russian grandfather says to a grandson when he can't say the thing that he really wants to say to him. Grandfather snorted as if he'd been asked to sell a perfectly healthy horse at half value. All the men were taken right away, Aaron, father, all the cousins. Father was too old for infantry, so they took him to heavy labor. 2 years later, there's a knock at the door. I see the skeleton in rags, so I shout to my mother, "Hey, there's a beggar at the door, give him some food." Not a strange sight in those days. And he starts weeping. It was father. A week later, they told us about Aaron, killed by artillery. I wanted to spare my mother losing the last of her men, so yes, I went to Uzbekistan. not to live in a palace, to pick pockets and piss myself on the street so they'd think I was a retard and not draft me. He looked away. Look, I came back. I enlisted. On a ship in liberated territory, Slava said. Look, I didn't make up the rules. The paper says ghettos, forced labor, concentration camps. What are you, Lenin's grandson? Grandfather said. Maybe I didn't suffer in the exact way I need to have suffered, he flicked a finger at the envelope. But you know what? They made sure to kill all the people who did. We had our whole world taken out from under us. No more dances, no holidays, no meals with your mother at the stove. A meal like this, he pointed to the living room. Do you know what it means to have a meal like this? Do you know what we came back to after the war? Tomatoes the size of your head. They'd fertilize them with human ash. You follow? So now you want your revenge, Slava said. Heist the German government. The German government, grandfather said. The German government should be grateful to get off this easy. This German government didn't kill anyone, Slava said. So we should say thank you? Grandfather slapped his hands. What is it? Slava said. Do you need more money? He pointed around them, the bureau, the bed, the tricked-out lamps keeping sentry in the corners of the room. Money, grandfather said, drawing back. Money makes the world go round. Money's not the only reason, but I don't know anyone who's been hurt by money. Why did you never tell me any of that before, Slava said, about evacuation? We didn't want those ugly things in your head. We wanted you above us. Enough hands had to go in the dirt so yours wouldn't have to. So, Slava said, this is a rose you're asking me to smell? It's family, Slavic. Let's skip the big words, if you don't mind. It's crime. That's our family. Do you know what the punishment is if we're caught? I would give my right arm for you, if that's what it took. That's family. If that's what took? You safe. You happy. Grandfather slapped the nightstand between them. This conversation is over. I don't need your services. I don't need your right arm. Thank you.